Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this session with Susan Johnson. Firstly, our acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge this land that we meet on today is the traditional lands for the Kaurna people and that we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Anne.
And congratulations on this terrific memoir, Aphrodite's Breath. It's
so
good to be with you, and I so enjoyed reading it. I think we'll get straight into it. Susan, why did you want to move to the tiny Greek island of Kythera? You gave up your job and all the attendant security of remunerated employment. Why? What prompted this? And why did you ask your 85-year-old mother, Barbara, to go with you?
All excellent questions. And I know that Louise Adler said to me, I can understand you going by yourself, but why did you take your mother? A long, complicated answer was I was a single parent, the sole financial provider for my two sons, Casper and Elliot, and I had been for 10 years. I had... Prior to that, being a full-time writer of fiction, but I think I've said this once, and I'm sorry if you've heard it before, but Australian authors earn about $20,000 a year, average Australian author, except Trent Dalton, who I worked with at the Courier Mail. Actually, I was on the Q Weekend magazine, which is the colour magazine. For the Courier Mail, under Matthew Condon, another wonderful Australian writer. And Trent at the time was writing his first book, and both Matt and I, being seasoned novelists, and, you know, we're giving all this advice. It's hard out there, Trent, you know, $20,000 a year, you know. Anyway, so that's it. The buy story was that I'm actually a $20,000, you know, dollar a year Australian author. I haven't won a big prize. I haven't... you know, my biggest selling book was The Broken Book, which came out in 2006, I think. So the question is, I wanted to go back to writing, but how do I do it? What happened? A whole lot of things happened. My sons both left home. They're very similar in age. They were going to be leaving home. At the same time, print newspapers are dying, and so redundancies were being offered. So I thought, well, this is a way, you know, if the boys were going back to London, I'm a dual citizen of UK and Australia, if they're going back to live with their dad, I won't have any financial, commitment. And maybe living in Greece, because I have got a lot of friends in Greece, is a cheaper way for someone like me to survive as a writer. However, then is the question of mum. My dad had died 10 years before, and I'm the only daughter, and I'm the first child, and I'm sure I said this before, many women in the audience will know that you become, if you're the daughter, that it still often falls on the daughter to be the carer for the remaining parent. So I had kind of become mum's significant other. So I really did give it a lot of thought, obviously, and then I just sort of said to mum, on the spur of the moment, what do you think about moving to Greece with me? And to my astonishment, she said yes. So that's how it happened.
Well, Susan, you say in the memoir that you had a romantic fantasy about life on this island. Your words, romantic fantasy. And that you imagined it as an earthly paradise. Again, your words. Tell us about that first visit to the island when you were a young woman and whether that informed this decision to try and go again to live there 40 years later.
Well, I'm not Greek, and no one in my family, I'm not of Greek heritage, but I did have the great good fortune. Are there any Greek Australians here in the audience or anyone from... Yassas, and from I had the great good fortune to go to school with a bunch of girls from Kythera, Kythera, we all know that that most Greek Australians ended up in Melbourne, you know, because we've got Athens, Thessaloniki, and then Melbourne as the third largest Greek city in the world. But the ones that went to Brisbane tended to be from Kythera. And Kythera is an island below the Peloponnesus, but above Crete, but it's not very well known. It's not on the tourist trail, which is a good thing. But I just basically fell in love with this family called the Komnenos family, Komnenos. And it was an ordinary suburban school that we went to, so it was suburban Brisbane. They lived across the road, but they had in their backyard a kippo, a garden, and a goat, right across the road from, you know, and their dad had a shotgun, and, you know, it was like they were the most extraordinary family. Gregoria made wonderful food. So I fell in love with them first. And then the year after I left school, I went to University of Queensland part-time, and I was working as a journalist. I saved up enough to go to Greece for the first time. And I was telling this story to the ABC before. I'm not sure. I hope no one's heard this. But it was the year that Maggie Thatcher was newly in. There was garbage. There was a garbage strike. There was a sort of a services strike in the UK. So we're talking 1976, I think. It's a famously cold winter. Piles of garbage in the street in London. I'd saved up enough to go to Europe. It was pretty miserable in London, absolutely freezing in Paris, snowing, but we travelled south. We went right down through Italy towards the sun. Even in Italy it was cold. Then we got on the ferry, for those of you who remember going on the Brindisi ferry across to Greece. And then when we got to Greece, we emerged. It was like we emerged into light. It was an exceptionally beautiful period of pre-carnival. So carnival is part of the Greek Orthodox religious calendar, and it was just absolutely glorious. And so I fell in love with Greece itself and the Greek culture, but then we went to the island and I absolutely, you know, it was just amazing to someone like me who was, you know, pretty, you know, white Anglo-Saxon. My father had worked for an American company, but I hadn't been overseas at that stage. So a couple of years after that, I went to live in Greece as a young woman when I was about 21, and I lived on the island for about 7 months. So the question about whether I had this romanticised idea, only afterwards did I ask myself, is it because I was young? Everybody looks back on their youth at some period of, you know, went around Australia or they did. Whatever that period of shining youth is when, you know, you've got nothing, no obligations, no responsibilities, the whole of life is before you. Whether it was that mixed up with it, I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Thank you. So, Susan, in contrast, I think, with your rapturous rediscovery of the island and its history and people, your mother found very little that delighted her. How did the two of you initially cope with your different feelings, your different reactions to being on the island? How did that go?
Mum was quite well travelled, but when I was talking about Dad was originally a Queenslander who'd gone to Sydney. And Mum was from Sydney, so it was a mixed marriage, you know, Queenslanders in those days. And, you know, he was a Methodist and Mum was sort of Irish working class, they weren't very religious. So she kind of felt like she married up because Dad went to a private school in Brisbane but he went on to become, he was also a journalist when he was young, then he went on to become a businessman. So he worked for 3M, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. And only when I saw Mad Men, the series years later, did I realise that's what was my childhood. My mum was always cooking dinners for visiting Americans, you know, like she was the hostess, you know. Dad used to go to America on business a lot. We'd always be taking Americans to look at koalas at the zoo, you know, all that sort of stuff. Mum was travelled. You know, but then I realised she was travelled on business class, you know, like Dad was, you know, like they'd go. So she wasn't really, it wasn't the same kind of travel as, you know, backpacking through Europe as we did when we were, some of you might have done when you were young, Ural Pass and things like that. She'd been to Greece, but when she went to Athens, she stayed at the Grand Britannia. Do you know it's the hotel in Athens. She had been to some islands, but I think they'd always stayed in, you know, pretty nice places. I did try and tell her as much as I could about the place. And, of course, I looked very, very diligently to try and get a place. The island is not very touristy still, but there's small villages. I wanted to get a village where she could walk to have a coffee and or go to the shops. You know, I took a great deal of care in trying to find the place, but as soon as she walked into that house, she hated it. And, you know, when I think back on it, I think it was all kinds of things. Mum used to drive in Australia. She was, you know, very, very, you know, astute, quick on her feet, would drive everywhere. I was doing the driving in Greece. She didn't decide not to get an international driver's licence. I'd chosen the house. I'd done, you know, suddenly she felt I was in charge. And before that, she was very much in charge. So I didn't tell the publisher, I didn't tell my agent, I didn't tell anybody, but within a month of arriving, she'd booked her ticket back. She really didn't like it. It was really cold as well. She was really... You know, it was really, really upsetting. You know, it was quite clear to me very, very soon that, you know, it was going to go pear-shaped.
Susan, I wonder if you'd like to read something that might tell us something about what it was like at the beginning on the island and what was going on for the two of you.
Yeah.
What it was like living with each other again, mother-daughter, after so many years.
So I think I'd always... Look, I found a lot of things about our relationship during this period, but Mum chose a second house, so she kind of took a bit more control by choosing this second house. But it turned out that the first house, I'd signed a contract, and I felt really bad about giving up this house, you know, really bad, because this woman, we'd gone to a lot of trouble doing it because it was on Airbnb, and I don't know if anybody has tried to get around the Airbnb algorithm of trying to actually ask if you can rent a house long term. It's really hard. So I'd finally got this house, and then Mum wanted this other house. But when we spoke to Fortini about giving up the house, it turned out that of course she'd missed out on summer rentals because she'd given it to us, you know, for the year. So I'm just reading from this part after I'd found out from Fortini that she'd declined several opportunities to rent the house over summer and now she would be left with a vacant house. She said, because of our early departure, she was out of pocket to the tune of some 4,000 euros and we would need to find a way to cover this amount. That's ridiculous, said Mum. There's no way I'm paying another cent. Well, we did sign a contract, I said, and most contracts have penalties for breaking them. Most rental agreements have penalties for breaking them. Where? She said. Let me see. I went to my bedroom, found the contract, and quickly read it. There was no mention of any break clause. There's nothing here, Mum said. She read it. Yes, okay, I said, but that doesn't mean we aren't ethically obliged to offer some sort of compensation. You want to give them money when we don't have to? I said no more. I may have shrugged, perhaps I even looked miserable. However I looked, further enraged my mother. Why are you worried about hurting the feelings of someone you've never met? We are perfectly within our rights to leave. This house is not fit to live in. Which is not true, it was fit to live in. And then the vast dam of words inside me burst open and I was shouting. Of course it's fit to live in. Why am I worried about hurting the feelings of someone I've never met? I worry about hurting everyone's feelings. I worry about hurting yours. I spend my life trying to please you, trying to please everyone. Because I had controlling parents, I spend my whole life trying to appease. There was silence. The room turned cold. And I thought I heard the far-off sound of ice creaking in the glacier which had formed in the corner. Uh-oh.
Thank you. Susan, one of the other differences that comes out, and there are many between you and your mother, and it is quite hilarious in the memoir, is that you enjoy joking about sex and she does not. And the comic writing, I think, in the memoir is delicious, it's impressive. Did you have to work at this? And are there authors that you read who inspired you to write comic writing? Or, dare I say, does it come naturally to you?
Well, I'm a huge fan of writers who can somehow be profound, but also be aware of the kind of absurdities of life. You know, when you talk about, you know, I joke about sex. I don't actually talk about sex that much, actually, and I think that's partly to do with my mother. But I did make a joke because partly to do with her getting Greek citizenship. Because I'm a UK citizen. This is pre-Brexit. I didn't have to apply for Greek citizenship, but Mum had to go through this vast rigmarole of getting police checks, a syphilis test. And I thought her doctor would say, oh, just, you know, like, you don't have to do that, just I'll just, you know, write it off. But no, she had to go and have a syphilis test. So while she's in having a syphilis test, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is just like, you know, all these things I'm asking her to do, I mean, this is really bad. But she was quite, you know, okay about it. And when she came out and I said, well, and of course it was negative. Then I just said, well, now you can have safe sex with a Greek fisherman. And then she sort of looked at me and I mean, if you can't make a joke about an 85-year-old having a syphilis test, I knew, you know, but so I enjoy, I'll name some writers that I really like. Sigrid Nunez. If no one's read Sigrid Nunez, go quickly to the, I don't know, she's not here now, but there's a book called The Friend. She won the was it Pulitzer or the Book Award? National Book Award, I think, in America. She's a New Yorker. She's also was briefly Susan Sontag's daughter-in-law. She is, so it's called The Friend, and there's another book called, does anyone know the second one after that? She's absolutely wonderful. So she writes, in the second book, she writes about nothing less than nursing her friend who's dying of cancer. And yet somehow, even within that, she manages to have a great deal of fun with the notion of, you know, that they make jokes. I hope that's what I try to do in my work. I think my favourite writers are like that. Trying to think of some other. Charlotte Wood, I think, is wonderful. Charlotte Wood is terrific. You know, the Weekend is a wonderful example of humour in the midst of despair. And also, I think there's a human capacity for levity in dying. I mean, I've got a very dear friend who's just nursed her sister, who's dying, and I know that they had some very light moments and made a lot of jokes, and I think that that's humour is part of life, I think.
Thank you. Susan, a memoir is always an act of autobiographical performance, and you point this out in your earlier terrific memoir, A Better Woman, memoir of motherhood, written when you were younger. And you also point to the necessity of invention and refashioning in memoir. How do you balance privacy, the telling of other people's stories, and the quest for self-definition and truth-telling in your memoir and your autobiographical writing?
That is the big question, isn't it? You know, like, what, that is really the big question. You know, if I thought this was going to be, you know, a jolly lark sing of us going off, you know, it was quickly proved that it wasn't. But also, you know, Mum... How it happened, I got a... After I did take my redundancy, my voluntary redundancy, I was speaking to my publisher, my long-term publisher at Allen & Unwin, Annette Barlow, about it, and she said, well, you know, that would be a great book. I hadn't even thought of writing a book at that stage. But then I thought, well, if I've got a modest advance, that will help as well. So I had that advance. And so Mum knew right from the get-go that I was writing. You know, she knew, you know, right away. And she'd also known... It's not that I'm, you know, I've had this incredibly amazing life. The reason it's kind of accidental how I ended up with two memoirs. The first was originally going to be commissioned to be a sort of more like a Kaz Cook book, you know, like menopause. You know, Kaz Cook does those menopause books, more or women's, girls and women's books. It was going to be about more of a workbook about new motherhood. But events derailed me, and in fact what happened was I ended up with an extremely rare birth trauma disorder. A birth trauma. So I ended up doing something else. And then I had to protect my husband, my then husband, during that period. So with this book, I got derailed majorly, both by the circumstances of Mum wanting to go back. And at one stage screamed at her, well, just go back whenever you want, you know, if you're going to be miserable, just go. And she said, oh, well, I can't go back because you've got to write the bloody book. So, you know, I mean, you know, really, big issue. But then what happened was we got derailed even more because Mum pretty much stayed the best part of a year in the end. You know, it was about 10 months and my brother was coming. So he my brother Stephen basically took Mum home. They went home, travelled home together. And then I got stuck by COVID. So I was there for another year getting, because I couldn't get home because Australia, you know, the government shut the doors. But then what happened was, because I was away for a year, by the time Mum left and when I got back in January 2021, when I finally got back, when she picked me up, when Stephen and Mum picked me up, I was so shocked. She had aged incredibly. She had had a fall. She had a, you know, what, anything to do with older people. Once they fall, we all know that, you know, that's the kind of, it can be the beginning of the end. So she tripped over a box in Stephen's pantry and broken her pelvic bone. So she'd been in hospital and she'd had a lot of physiotherapy. She cut her hair. And Mum was a great beauty and she was also, very, very conscious of how she looked. She had this big sweep of silver hair which she wore up in a French roll. And so when she met me at the airport, she was much more stooped over. She'd shrunk and she had cut her hair. And so that was the biggest shock. So that was... I don't think I'm giving... Oh, I don't know. I'm going to tell the whole end of the story. So basically, Mum passed away. And then I was diagnosed with cancer. So major derailing of everything, right? At that stage, I thought, well, I can't write this at all now. So I did all my sums. I added up the publisher's advance money. I had $17,000 grant advance from the Australia Council. Thank you to the Australia Council because it supports people like me who do earn $20,000 a year. I added all this up and I realised I couldn't afford to give the money back. I just could not afford to give the money back. So I had to write it. So I told my publisher that I wouldn't be able to meet the deadline, but could I have an extension? And she very kindly, Annette gave me an extension. And then I had to work out a way to write it. And so all those ethical problems that you're talking about were a millionfold then, because the one thing I didn't want to do is betray my mother.
No.
She's not there to defend herself. She would have so enjoyed being up here talking about, you know, talking about everything. And, like, we did one ABC interview before we left, and I said to Mum, it was live, I said, oh, you know, you don't have to do it, Mum, you know, you like, because I'm used to it now, even though I can speak underwater now, but when I first published, I had to do a public speaking course. I was so terrified. I just thought, I can write the book, but I cannot speak. So I had learnt to do it, but I thought Mum mightn't be comfortable. She was amazing. Live, and I'm going, oh my God, we did this amazing interview, live, ABC. She was absolutely nerveless. She was fine. So she would have loved all this. And it was a real question for me to, you know, how do I depict her without, you know, I'm the one, you know, like right in the beginning I talked about me being the violator and she being the violated in some ways because... you know, it's a real moral issue.
Yeah.
It was helped by the fact that I found something she wrote. And I won't give too much away, but I did find something.
Yeah. I wonder if we could just stick with this for a minute. You know, Susan, that George Orwell famously remarked that, quote, autobiography is only to be trusted when it reveals something disgraceful. And this is autobiography because this is also about your life. And your earlier life, your whole life. He went on, he said, a man who gives a good account of himself is probably lying, since any life, when viewed from the inside, is simply a series of defeats. Does that comment about life as a series of defeats resonate with you as a writer of memoir?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I interviewed Devorah Baum from London earlier in the week, and she's written this wonderful book called On Marriage, and she was talking about you know the histories of marriage and it's a fascinating book, and I said to her, I admitted that I had this feeling because I'm twice divorced, that I failed in some way. So, you know, and I have children. And when I said that, the audience went, because like one in four people are divorced now, one in three people are divorced. So it's a really, really common thing. But I'm very, very, I tend to be quite self-critical. So it doesn't take much for me to identify with that quote because I do think, I think it's good for writing because it keeps you on your toes. It keeps you humble and it keeps you from thinking you know, like there's a lot of egocentricity involved in writing because I just taught a memoir class at for Writers South Australia, and the very act, I quote Winnicott, you know, the very act of saying I am is an aggressive one, and the very act of writing I am and controlling a story is an aggressive one. But I am also conscious that people often think in my... And also in my novels as well as my books, that I just sort of write down my diaries. And I've had a lot of conversations with Helen Garner and people like that, that people think that, like, even a novel such as The Spare Room, which is very much created from an event in her life, is still a crafted work. And that's what I would say, that it takes away the work involved in making a book. It really is work. And so I think having that notion of failure, I mean, I think a lot of writers have that.
And defeats. It's such an interesting
and defeat.
Choice of word.
Yeah. Yeah. And defeat. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, in fact, I was just reading an article in... I subscribed to the New York Review of Books, and there was an article about... well, also here, actually, with Adam Phillips on giving up. Did anyone see that? Fabulous, yeah. So he's a psychoanalyst from London. And the whole notion of... It's actually quite important to say something like 99.9% of humanity is extinct, or all of species on the Earth, 99.9 species on the Earth at any time are now extinct from the time of life on Earth, right? Human life is one brief flicker between two nothingnesses, and in fact, the whole notion of success, our notion of success is about refusing to face the fact that it's all about small ways of saying, I am here, I'm alive, I'm not dead. You know, I'm very conscious, I've always been quite conscious of, the kind of briefness of life and my own smallness, I suppose. I mean,
Yeah, and on that, you've lived for many years abroad, you've lived in the UK, you've lived in France. I wonder if you could say something about living away and writing about exile, which you have written about a bit, and also about language because you didn't have Greek when you were living on the island. What's it like to be trying to write when you don't speak the language about those people?
Look, yeah, that's...
And living away, that other bigger question that's been a huge one for you in your work.
Well, not having Greek language it still feels quite shameful to me. See, that's a defeat. To me, that feels like a defeat. I don't think I'm terribly good with Greek, any languages, I don't think. I think I learnt, I was too old by the time, I think I was about 16 when I had to, my parents moved from Sydney to Queensland and I had to be enrolled in... fourth form French, and we'd done Indonesian at St Ives. We had a smoking room, and we had St Ives High was the height of the Vietnam moratorium, and so we learned Indonesian, and so learning French, it was quite hard. I think the whole notion. I was very conscious. I didn't want to write. Be a rich Western person coming to a country and writing about the jolly locals. You know, I was really conscious of that, and I was conscious of not explaining their own culture to them or saying, how wonderful here I am to tell you about your life. One of the great things to me is that I've become very, very dear friends with Kitherians, and no one has said to me, they all love... Many of them have very, very sad stories, and this book was actually twice as thick because I put a lot of the stories of exile and migration. It for some reason, it's always been a very powerful thing to me, and they feel I've honoured them, which is one thing that's been really important to me. But exile, I mean, I know we've with your book about Australian writers. Who were in exile that you wrote with Bruce. It's Australian writers have long had a relationship with exile because early in white Australia's history, culture was elsewhere. And so there was a long period where if you wanted to have culture, I've just done a big piece on David Malouf for the Monthly. And he was exactly the same age as my mum. And he said for him, he grew up with the idea of elsewhere, just absolutely elsewhere. He left as soon as he could. And that generation often did. Christina Stead, David Malouf. By the time it came to my generation, it was a sort of inverse version of the cultural cringe. It was like you were ratting out on your country if you did leave. You're supposed to stay and contribute to Australian culture. And I still think there's a bit of that now, that, why do you want to go and leave? But for me, for whatever reason, I am interested in being elsewhere. I've lived in Hong Kong, I've lived in France, I've lived in the UK for, 10 years. I think it's an interesting thing for an author to actually look back at your country when you're not in that place.
Yes, thank you. Susan, one of the other very interesting elements of this memoir is that the stories of other people that you interweave with your own and with your mother's And you spent a lot of time exploring the life of Rosa Casamati. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about this woman, this extraordinary woman, and why you were working on her and her significance.
Well, when I first gave my the book to both my agent and my publisher, I had so much more history in it. And I think I told you that you know, that they both, in their own ways, my agent was much blunter. He said, what did he say? You know, when you say something's got promise, or sort of like, you know, it's got, like, no, not, potential. It wasn't quite, yeah, potential, something like that. And he just said, you know, I got to all the history part and I was just going, I want to find out about you and your mother. So, and then my publisher, who's much more diplomatic, basically she said the same thing. But I fought to hold on to Rosa Casamati's because I thought there was a connection there. Kithara is a place where people often just walked out of their houses and left their houses behind. You know, like they walked out of the kitchens, you'd find clothes in the cupboard. You would find there's abandoned houses all over, as there are in other parts of Greece as well, but specifically Kithara, because they really suffered after the Second World War, huge poverty crisis. And I came across the story of Rosa Casamati's. How did I first come across? No, because we came across her house, and there's a plaque which says, this is the house of Rosa Casamati's, who wasn't anybody in her own right. She's the mother of Lefkadio Hearn. Now, some of you may know of Lefkadio Hearn's work. He was the sort of the person who introduced Japanese literature to the West, essentially. His mother was Greek. His father was Irish, because the English were on the island for 250 years. And as part of the English army, there were Irish people in the English army. And so he basically was an Irish bit of a philanderer who seduced this local village girl, Rosa Casamati's. And, of course, it was a huge scandal. They left, went to Corfu. She had the baby there, fell pregnant very soon with a second baby, which was Lefkadio. The baby, the husband was sent off to the West Indies. She was alone on Corfu, not in her own, on her own island. She had lost a baby. She had a new baby. She had no family support. Her family disowned her. And then basically she was rescued by someone from the British Army and sent back to Ireland. She had no English. She was sent back to Dublin in the middle of winter to his family and basically promptly went mad. You know, I think the notion of exile, I don't think we quite understand being deprived of your language for a start. You know, so I bow down to all the wonderful Catherian migrants who've come up to me afterwards when I do a lot of events in the Greek community. Because I just love, you know, the stories of these people, and also in the Catherian community, and the stories they tell of how awful the experience was of coming to this country with no language. Many of them, I must say, went to the country areas, were befriended by indigenous people. They are very, very close to many Greeks, to indigenous communities, because indigenous communities welcomed them. White Australia didn't. You know, they're very, very. I know many Greeks that are very close to indigenous communities and feel very grateful for that. So I became really interested in Lefkadio's story, Rosa's story. Rosa eventually was rescued from Ireland. She came back to the island of Kithara. She was basically forced into a second marriage. She had three children in quick succession. She tried to go back and see her two children. She'd also had another child after Lefkadio. She tried to get back to Dublin to see her children. They wouldn't let her inside the door. So she was not only lost one child, she couldn't see her two original children that she'd left and had with this Irishman. So she basically came back broken to Kithira, and then was forced into a second marriage. Had three children, basically went mad. So she was put in the asylum in Corfu, where she lived for 23 years and died on Corfu, and she's buried in an unmarked grave in Corfu. You know, so that is one exile story that really, really spoke to me. And in fact, if you want to read about it, there's an American writer, a very American Vietnamese writer called, it's going to escape me, Sweet Fruits, I think the name Sweet. Is, Sweet Fruits, mm-hmm. who's written the stories of the women in Lef Cadio Hearn's life. Rosa's story, his second wife, because he went off, he was went down to South America. He was in Louisiana. He was kind of friendly with Mark Twain and all that. I mean, fascinating life. And then he went to Japan. And then he became a Japanese, like learnt Japanese and married a Japanese woman and had a child in Japan. And so now there's this amazing link between Kithira and Japan. There's the Japanese come all the time too, because Lef Cadio Hearn is a big influential figure in Japan. So Lef Cadio, I used it a lot as a jumping off point.
Thank you. Susan, I wonder if you could just tell us, we will open up for questions in a few minutes, but I'd love to hear you talk about Easter and the church and then the dancing and the transformations of spring and summer on the island, and for you and your mother.
Yeah, it really it was even transformative for Mum. Even Mum, you know, as soon as the sun started to come out, her experience was very different then. It was joyous. I mean, Carnival, Kithira follows the religious Greek Orthodox calendar quite closely, and there's name days for the saints, for the Greeks. You have name days. There's many celebrations throughout the Greek calendar year. But Easter is a absolutely wonderful time of year where every community will have its own roast spit lamb on the. You know, they'll do the lamb. They have dancing. They'll have big community tables. And the second house we went to, we were very, very fortunate. It belonged to Maria and Manolis. Not Casimatis, but they were related to the Casimatis, and they basically invited us to Easter lunch before we moved to the house. And Maria greeted us with this armful of roses from the garden and springfuls of mint. Manoli, well, I'm so lucky that I met them. Manoli grows all his own produce. He collects salt, sea salt. So you're sitting. He's never got idle hands ever. He will crack nuts. They will do every. They live by the seasons, completely by the seasons. And the other thing is, they've both been to Brisbane, Brisbanica, as they call it. There's a lot of Anika villages in Kithira, and so it became Brisbanica. And they know Brisbanica, and they said to me that they also think that they're quite like Aboriginals. You know, they know every nook and cranny. They know everything about their land and their place. And, in fact, all publishers now have sensitivity readers. And I was asked whether that was... would that be offensive to Indigenous people? And I don't think it. I don't think so, because they were the ones who said it, and they know about Indigenous life and how, you know, the wonderful welcome to country that was given here at the opening by an Indigenous man here. He spoke about, this is my hair, this is my hand. I don't say this is my place because I belong. This place doesn't belong to me, I belong to it. And that's what Kitherians are like. They understand that they owe the earth its bounty, you know. And we were very, very lucky to now be friends, you know, to be considered friends.
Thank you. I'm going to ask just one more question and then we will open up. I found the last section, Susan, really moving and very hard to read because of the emotional intensity of it. And I just wanted to ask you about what it was like writing that and how long you waited to write that section about what happened to your mother and what happened to you with the serious illness.
It really is a question of like holding my nose and just trying to write it as fast as I could. That's what happened. That was the answer was everything else was really, really structured. And thank God I'd had 10,000 words before Mum died. I already had 10,000 words. So all the beginning was already done. So I already had a voice. You know, like I'm sure there are people here who write themselves and, you know, we talk about voice, you know, like what's your voice? And luckily, that was already done. So, but towards the end, and as I said to you, my ethical problem about wanting to honour Mum, I've now asked two of her best friends, and I've asked family if they think Mum would be upset about it, because that's what I really didn't want to. And they both think that, well, her two best friends, they both thought that she wouldn't be upset. So that was the main thing. So I just had to just get it done. So I wrote it really fast, the answer is, really fast. And then I realised afterwards I'd actually put off my grieving. So because I got sick at Mum's funeral, I couldn't eat, I could drink water because I was having a colonoscopy the next day and I was diagnosed, like, at the colonoscopy, basically, like 2 days after Mum's funeral. So I suddenly went into cancer mode straight up, and I realised that it delayed Mum's, the grieving. And so therefore writing this and the whole, writing all that, it basically meant I just put off, I just covered up everything. And so the last year has been really, really hard, much, much harder than writing it.
I think we will open up for questions now. I can see someone there. Please make your questions a question. Please be respectful. There is a microphone. Are you ready? Yes.
I give a thanks first. Thank you, Susan and Anne, for a wonderful interview.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Thank you. So my question, I mean, maybe it's an idea in the future to send my parents off to a Greek island. That sounds like a great idea. Writing a book, do you think you could write a memoir that was ostensibly a memoir but was really a historical account? So, like you said that your publishers didn't really like the history bit. Do you think you could write a memoir but it really was just the history of the island?
That's a really good question. I think you probably could. I mean, the Catherians have got something called the Catherian World Heritage Organisation, in which they have, because there's been a lot of Catherians who've made very good money in Australia. George Miller is Catherian. Miller, he comes from Miller Potomos. George Miller, the director. So the Catherian Association's got a lot of money and they want to publish the unexpurgated version of this. I think you could. You'd have to do more of it. If it was going to be a memoir, you'd have to somehow bring people to life throughout history, I think, possibly. I think that would be the way to do it. You could still, like I've done with Rosa, maybe you would do that with other people throughout history. I got some really amazing stories of people during the Second World War, because the Germans were on Kythera, as they were in many of the Greek islands. The Germans occupied Greece. And some of those stories of those children, like one old lady told me her mother taught her to cry to German soldiers so she could get more food for the family. And so she was a little actor. She was about six and she was taught, you know, all these stories of memories that they were told. I'm sure you could use those memories and kind of inhabit those memories in terms of a memoir. I think you could. So if you want to do it, I would do that. I think that sounds like a great idea.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for that. It was a terrific book. I really enjoyed it. And I just wondered if you could talk a bit about, like, to me, I wondered how long was it since you'd lived with your mother? And, you know, it just strikes me as being like, am I allowed to say, like a shitstorm of, like, issues to sort of not only decide to live with your mother but to take her away to a Greek island and, you know, play it all out in this kind of slightly hostile environment, if you like.
No, that's a really good question. And in fact, the answer is I think I was 62, because I was 62 when I went. I was 62 and I hadn't separated from my mother properly. And it wasn't till I went there and I realised that, I mean, I like, it's really embarrassingly old, isn't it? But, you know, you'd be amazed how many women come up to me. In fact, I had a Greek woman came up at the library at Logan in Queensland, and she was 78, and she was talking about her mother, who was 98 or something, at home, completely compos mentis, and she still couldn't say no to a mother. So I don't think it's unusual, you know. I really don't. I think that I was really... My mother was a very powerful figure. And in fact, getting back to the thing about writing, that I think I'm a writer because I had really powerful parents. It's the only way I could get any power. I think that's really true, you know. I mean, I think that that's my version. So I think that's a really interesting question. And I think that probably only by doing something that's so far removed from your normal circumstances, that it's all become clear and it sort of plays out. It's almost like accelerated psychodrama, accelerated psychoanalysis, you know, by putting yourself in that situation, and you realise all those issues that are there. My brother, I've got two younger brothers. My middle brother has got a completely different relationship with mum, and she would say to me, "Why do you let her get away? Why do you let her do this?" And I said, "Well, she doesn't do it to you. She didn't do it to him." You know, so I think there's a lot of women who have relationships with their mothers like that. Thank you. That was a great question.
We don't seem to have any more questions, so I would like to congratulate you, Susan. This is a superb memoir.
Thank you. I hope everybody
who hasn't yet read it will buy a book and read the book, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It's resonant for mothers and daughters everywhere, but parents and children. It's really powerful, and it's a really great read. Thank you, Susan, and congratulations.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you. Thank you.